Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. Co-host today, Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Paul. How are you?
Good. And Daniel, we have a special guest today, the author of Game of Thorns. He's a political expert. So if you have any political questions, Doug can answer them because I've worked with him and he knows what politics is all about. He's just recently written this book and it's Doug Weed. And Doug, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. Thanks for having me.
And I want you to say hello to Daniel McAdams, who is our co-host. He will have he's going to have the really tough questions for you.
Hi, Doug. It's good to have you with us. I got the
Thank
tough
you,
ones.
Daniel.
Okay, I want to emphasize at the beginning, we'll do a little bit more introduction, but I do want to emphasize the main reason why we got you here, because you have this very famous book, is about to become a bestseller on the New York Times list, and you've had books on that list before, and it's called The Game of Thorns, and very, very popular, and we urge our viewers to take a look at this and tell us what you think. So, but I'm delighted to have Doug on our program today. I've gotten to know him since about maybe 07, 08 in that campaign, and more so in 012. And he's actually been involved in Rand's campaign as well, too. But, you know, that's the important stuff. The little lesser importance of him being involved in politics was he was an insider with the first Bush administration. So that's really something there. But, Doug, it is great. Is that a negative to say that you were an insider with the H.W. Bush campaign and presidency?
Well, I enjoy being at home with I saw you on TV in the debates back in, I guess it was 2008. I thought, who is this guy? How can he be telling the truth like this on television? I've never heard of this. This is amazing. And so I made my transformation to a Ron Paul follower.
Well, that was wonderful because you've been very insightful and a good friend. But we want to talk some serious business because you do have a wealth of information about politics. You're well known for writing about presidential families and relatives, father and son relationships. So I think that is interesting. But just a general question to get us started. As you were doing this research and writing and planning for this book, it didn't happen just after the election was over. You had to be thinking about this. But in the process of putting this together, could you give me the idea or the issue or what you found to be the biggest surprise? What was your biggest surprise in this whole election?
My biggest surprise was these Clinton scandals were unfinished. The loose ends had not been tied up. And when I went back to revisit all of these Clinton scandals to write what I thought was old history, they were current. They were ongoing. The Chinagate scandal, Niglap Singh showed up on the streets of Manhattan with suitcases full of cash in 2016, right in the middle of the Trump-Clinton election, and the FBI arrested him on the streets. So that was Chinagate back in the Clinton era. It was shocking to me to see how the news media had totally ignored these ongoing scandals and how they impact the American economy. So that was the biggest surprise for me. And also, I was a little surprised to see the numbers. This won't surprise you, but how Drain the Swamp won the election. Your themes in the last 2 months of 2016 election won the election for Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, Trump played on this. The media didn't help, and the media was covering up a lot of the things that Hillary was involved in. But Trump played it up pretty big. He was going to put her away, imprison her. But the tone has changed. Now, is this sort of what you should expect? And what are the pros and cons of the new president coming in to saying, yeah, she did a lot of bad things. We need to pursue this. We need justice. We need to try to put her in prison versus what is happening. And it seems like nobody cares. We're tired thinking about this. So what would your advice be to a president on whether they should pursue something like this?
Yeah, well, the Clintons, yeah, they count on that. They count on the fact that people are going to move on. That's how they've survived. That's how, I mean, it's so odd. We have this thing, we have the media saying, well, Donald Trump's crazy. He thinks that his predecessor wiretapped him. Well, Hillary Clinton thought her predecessor had wiretapped her, and so did Bill Clinton. They ordered the Secret Service in to sweep the private quarters of the White House. This whole story's in Game of Thrones to try to find the bugs that they thought dear old George Herbert Walker Bush had planted in the private quarters of the White House. And when they weren't satisfied, they called the FBI in to sweep for bugs. And they became estranged from the FBI, and they started their own security office that was staffed by two of their own personnel. So you have a repeat of these things. It's not new with Trump. I do find it odd that they say Donald Trump's a Russian spy, and the first thing he does is increase military spending. I'm thinking he's not a very good Russian spy. And then they don't want to investigate the Clintons, even though the only exchange of money was with the Clintons. The Russians gave $2.6 million to the Clinton Foundation, and in return, they got the Uranium One deal, which gave Russia 20% of the uranium in America. And then they gave $2 million to the Clinton Foundation, and Hillary Clinton arranged for all of this technological transfer from Silicon Valley to Skolkova University, and they created their own massive IT operation thanks to money from the Clintons and Silicon Valley. And then she complains because they turned around and hacked into the DNC. Well, she gave them the snake that bit better.
Daniel has a question for you.
Yeah, that was interesting. You said you're surprised that the scandals are still around, and you touched on it a little bit, but isn't it funny? You know, it seems like the server story has died. But the other big story is how much Saudi money went into the Clinton Foundation, how much money from the Gulf states. You talk about these claims that that the Russians hacked the DNC. Well, we've never seen any evidence of it. They may well have done it. But we know for a fact the Saudis are putting millions of dollars up. The Gulf states were putting millions of dollars up. Why was that not more of a scandal?
Yeah, I think you know better than me, Daniel, but I think because the corporate media benefited. And I think that's part of the, I get into China and the transfer of wealth in China. The transfer of wealth from the United States to China is the largest transfer of wealth in world history outside of the Middle East. And that's money from America going to China. And they pay for their goods and services and products from us with cheap money. And they use hard currency to buy within China, but cheap money to bring from outside. Our trade deficit in 2015 was $367 billion. So when Trump says we're going to deal with China, we're going to straighten up this trade deal with China, you have pharmaceuticals upset, you have the Wall Street upset, you have the Clintons who got money from China for years, you can read about in Game of Thrones, you have them upset, you have establishment Republicans like the dear old Bushes upset, who have their own deals with China, the establishment Republicans, and I think that's why you see them pushing us to war with Russia, conflict with Russia, because you can't deal with China and Russia at the same time, and they want us preoccupied and scared of Russia, where the income tax rate is 15%.
You know, Doug, we struggle here to sort out the truth because it's difficult. But we're very interested in what's going on behind the scenes and who's really in the deep state and pulls the strings. And I know you've thought a lot about that and have been close to that. But we could argue, obviously, Hillary was very, very much involved. We know how she was involved. And we're always hopeful. We keep our fingers crossed and we talk about, you know, the hints that we got during the campaign of what Trump might do. But already we see signs from our viewpoint that things, you know, they're fighting like cats and dogs. But you know, the military keeps building up. The foreign policy really hasn't changed. We're sending more troops overseas right now. And there are a lot of appointments that we consider are close to the neocon position. So how do you sort that out? Do you think we're overreacting, or how to? We think sometimes that maybe the deep state is in conflict with each other. There's branches of it maybe having a partial influence. And even though Trump has said some favorable thing about, well, we ought to look into this Fed, you know, we're not expecting, you know, with this administration to care about the Federal Reserve. And it looks like there'll be trouble repealing the welfare state. It looks like we will have the warfare state. So where do you put Trump in this category of his position with the people behind the scenes, the real deep state?
I don't know that I trust any of them but you, Dr. Paul. I follow what you say. I'm listening as you're struggling with this. I saw Donald Trump as the class clown. I didn't like the things he was saying about the fat girl across the room, but I liked the fact that he was disrupting the class and poking the nose of the suffocating, dominating teacher who needed to be, somebody needed to turn over the tables and smash some dishes. So my expectations are not high. If he can mess things up and move the cheese and force the people who have corrupted this system to find new ways to steal money, that's about the best I can hope for personally. So I like the fact that he's disruptive. I like the fact that they didn't want him to win. But other than that, I'm watching your channel and I'm listening to some of your scholars that are affiliated with you as they sort out these details. Right now, I don't know how long Trump's going to last.
Okay, Daniel.
You know, the Clinton people, of course, as we talked about earlier, they want to blame the defeat on the Russians hacking. That's the whole problem. But you write about the bubble effect in your book, about how Hillary and Hillary's people were in kind of a bubble where they were all reinforcing each other. They were deceiving each other. Do you think that was a real factor in her loss?
I think it was part of it. Part of it was hubris. I mean, she outspent him 8-1 if you count the super PACs, and she outstaffed him 5-1. She had 960,000 volunteers on the ground, almost double what Obama had on the ground. She had Eric Schmidt of Google, the CEO of Google, running her IT. She had all of Hollywood, all of academia, all of Wall Street, all of the international banks. And the people, many of the people that I met who voted for Donald Trump had not read Ron Paul's books. They didn't understand how the Fed worked or how the Import-Export Bank worked, but they had this innate sense that there's corruption, that something's going on. And it was that innate sense and that last theme of drain the swamp that helped put him over. It's terrible what's happened in our country. It's like the Congo. It's like like Brazil. It's everything for sale. So the best we can hope for with Donald Trump, for those who have studied this, in my opinion, is what I said, that he is disrupting things. But you're absolutely right on, Daniel. Bill Clinton got so mad. In my book, there's a scene where he takes his phone and he throws it off the rooftop of his pad at the presidential library in Little Rock because she's not going after the Catholic vote. And I don't know if anybody takes the time to read these emails that were exposed, but if you read the emails, it's horrendous. There's an email exchange in there where they talk about coming to power, the Clinton, and they're going to co-opt the Catholic Church and rewrite its doctrines to make them more liberal. And they call it a Catholic Spring. And Bill Clinton was saying, you need to get out ahead of this and say, no, we're not going to do this. And her response and her staff was, oh, that will call more attention to it. The media isn't picking this up. They're ignoring it. Let's leave it alone. But that surely cost them Catholic votes in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan.
Well, we have a little bit of time left, but I do have one question. It's sort of a philosophic question and a strategy question. At least on the internet, you're given credit or blame, regardless, I guess it depends on which way you're coming from. You've coined this word compassionate conservative. And I, you know, like that because I believe in true conservatism. Libertarianism offers an opportunity for compassion. We should have it. But I think some people took it, and I want you to expand on this a little bit, that some people took this mean if you're going to be a conservative, you have to have the compassion of a bleeding heart liberal, and that's quite a bit different. But I think for libertarian and constitutionalism to succeed, it really is a lot easier for us if we have a group of people who are compassionate, and I think the American people are very compassionate, but do you see a little bit of confusion there where some people would like to use that term and use it as an excuse? Well, we're conservatives, but we better get the message that we have to join the welfare programs that are proposed by the left.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, Lenin said if you define the language and the terms, you can win the argument. So people always take terms. You know, you remember that the blue states used to be the Republican and the red states were the Democrats. They flipped them because they were embarrassed. Red square, red flag. I'd rather be dead than red. And the Democrats and the left was embarrassed by being associated with red. It's no longer global warming. It's climate change. On and on it goes. Let's change the language. And when I talked about compassionate conservative, others have taken it to mean less conservative, more liberal. I didn't mean it that way at all. I meant free markets are more compassionate, that a poor person has a better chance of success in life in a free market, free enterprise system than they do in a leftist Swedish socialism or communist Soviet communist system. I believe true compassion is true non-crony capitalism, but true free enterprise and free markets where you know if you work for something, you can have it. That's right. What I meant.
And Daniel has one more short question, and then we'll be closing shop here in a minute.
All right. This is a quickie, and it really is switching gears a little bit, but you know, you are an expert on first families, and so I didn't want to get by without asking a question. Ivanka Trump, Kushner Trump, now we'll have our own office in the White House with access to classified information. Jared Kushner, who's the president's son-in-law, is in charge of some sort of special initiatives. They're speculating it has to do with maybe privatization of some government functions. What do you make of the very, very prominent role of the first daughter and her husband?
Well, we've had it all through history. We've had 18 sons of presidents who actually had offices in the White House. Most recently, Chip Carter and Jack Ford. Susan Ford was a photographer who worked in the White House photography shop. We had many, many women, even early in American history. Martha Johnson, who was the daughter of Andrew Johnson, ran the White House when he was under impeachment. And the last year in office, FDR, his daughter, Anna Roosevelt, ran things. There's a scene in my book, All the Presidents' Children, where Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady, comes to her daughter Anna and is begging to go to Yalta to be on the manifest for the trip to Yalta, and her daughter says no. So it's nothing new, and it's good to have people in there that are loyal to you. If Ron Paul were president, I think he should have family members in there helping him.
Okay, we're going to have to call to close in, but I want to thank you, Doug, very much for being on. I want to show you the book one more time so people can go and get it, Game of Thorns. And I'm sure they're going to find it very interesting. You have a lot of stories to tell, so and it's very, very entertaining. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for what you're doing for America, Dr. Paul, and good to meet you, Daniel.
And I want to thank our viewers for tuning in today to this very interesting discussion. And please come back to the Ron Paul Liberty Report soon.